Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When we are far from the facts, we sometimes turn to fiction to try to understand. That's how it has been for much of the world, trying to look past the bombast and bluster of the North Korean regime, trying to imagine real life in North Korea. Adam Johnson has just won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction for his imagined exploration of an individual life in the totalitarian state. This hour On Point, imagining North Korea, and Adam Johnson's The Orphan Master's Son. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation never ends. What do you think those masked North Koreans dancing in the squares of Pyongyang are thinking about their own lives? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Stanford, California, is Adam Johnson. He's just won the Pulitzer Prize in Fiction for his book, The Orphan Master's Son. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Adam Johnson, congratulations on your Pulitzer and welcome.
Thank you much. It's great to be here. The award was a nice surprise.
Kind of wild for it to come at a time. I mean, it does every year just in this month from the Pulitzers, but to come at a time when North Korea is so prominent in the news, where for day after day after day before the bombings of a week and a half ago, it was North Korea and nuclear threats right up front all the time.
Well, it's interesting. You know, I worked on the book for many years, for about 6 years. And while I was, creating the novel, many people said to me, oh, you're crazy. You can't write about North Korea. Nobody wants to read about North Korea. But with the death of Kim Jong-il in December of 2011, just 15 months ago, I think the world took its first serious look in a long time at North Korea, a place that we dismissed as, at least in our culture, it seemed to me, as a place of buffoonery or evil or absurdity.
Do you put your wonderful novel, now Pulitzer Prize-winning fiction, The Orphan Master's Son, do you put it forward as a serious look at North Korea, or do you put it forward as a serious effort at imagination?
Well, it's certainly a hybrid, and that's one of the things most people are curious about is, you know, what's real in it and what's not real. It is a work of imagination, but it's set in a real place. Kim Jong-il is a character in the book, so people want to know, you know, what they can, you know, lean on as something solid that will help, you know, fill out their knowledge of the place. Most of the facts in the book, I would say, are true, but my aim was to, you know, create a portrait of what it might be like to live under, you know, this thought system and to live in a world with this different hybrid of options.
What drew you to that? I mean, a lot of people, when North Korea is not blustering, tend, I think, just to put it entirely out of mind. I spent a lot of time in that part of the world, so I have an awareness of it. But I think talking with people about North Korea, and many just see this cold, forbidding, kind of blank-faced, mysterious country. And yet you poured yourself into a gigantic act of imagination and more about it. What drew you?
Well, you know, it's a place where people are just as human as we are. They want the same things. They want security, safety, better things for their kids. They're just trapped in a very, very strange place. I teach a class at Stanford on novel writing in which, you know, I get young writers and we try to, you know, look at how to write books and we read books. And every year I try to throw in a memoir into that. So as we try to fake, you know, fictional characters' lives, we can, you know, adjust our barometer by reading the real life story of someone who's capturing their own history. And in 2004, I taught a book called The Aquariums of Pyongyang by Kang Chol-hwan. And it was the story of Kang, who went into one of the largest gulags in North Korea, a Kwanli-so camp, at the age of 9, and he spent 9 years there. And I didn't know there were gulags in North Korea. I thought that system was gone in the world. I didn't know that there were family gulags. You know, I didn't understand how they worked. I honestly didn't know that much about the Korean Peninsula's history or the Korean War. And I found it a very mysterious, intriguing place. And very quickly over the course of a year, just for personal interest. I read about 10 books. And I'm a fiction writer. I just started writing dialogues and scenes. And most of the books I found were about economics or the military dimension or the politics. I wanted to find stories of people. And once I found the stories of defectors, which more and more came online, I really became immersed in what it would be like to be there.
What's a family gulag?
Oh, well, you know, the two largest, you know, there are many different camps. If you commit an infraction against the state, you could be sent to a re-education farm, a collective work farm. There are kind of gulags you can go to for a while. And then there are the total control zone prisons. The two big ones are Camp 14 and Camp 15. Camp 15 is called Yodok. And in the early 70s, Kim Il-sung made a rule called the Three Generations Rule. And if someone in your family, you know, commits an offense against the state, the whole family goes without trial, without sentence, and they go forever. And what that does is it transfers the terror system to the family. And so within the family, since they're all in jeopardy for the action of one, they begin policing each other. And that increases the control the state has.
We've seen this, the images and the sound of this fierce, angry militancy in recent weeks. Here's just a little bit. This is an undated video from North Korean state TV, but it's the kind of thing it's what we associate with. What comes out to the outside world of North Korea shows soldiers in military drills and firing weapons and charging hills. Let's listen. It's so theatrical, and I've heard much more theatrical even than that we sort of assume it's a mask. Do you see it that way? And if so, it's what is the mask intended to convey, and what's behind it?
Well, there are many things going on there. One thing I think we should think about is that, you know, when you look at the history of the Korean Peninsula and the Korean people, for a millennium, they have been kind of a plaything between larger powers in the region, Mongolia, China, Japan. They've been invaded and occupied in many different ways, often quite terribly. If you look at just the last century, the Japanese invade in 1910. They make Korean culture basically illegal. For 35 years, they completely subjugate the Korean people. They export 800,000 Korean citizens to the mainland to work in the Imperial War factories. Then there's World War II. Then there's partition by the superpowers, America and Russia. Then there's the Korean War. And in the North, there's 60 years of a totalitarian society. So for a century, they've had nothing but conflict, and they've been totally divorced from their tradition. And, you know, for a millennium, they've really had it rough from other powers. One thing that's very important in the North is the fact that they have had self-determination, and they've not been occupied by another power in three generations. And for them, that is a serious achievement that can't be overlooked. And but the state has co-opted that possible threat of invasion or occupation, you know, to control the people even more. But it is a big deal to them to have their self-determination and independence. It's ever in their minds.
So in that fierce display of threat that we see again and again in video and in rhetoric, how have you come to interpret that? You think and write a lot about propaganda in The Orphan Master's Son. But is that North Koreans saying, wow, this will freak them out overseas. This will freak them out abroad. Look how fierce we look. Or is it satisfying to be in a screening room somewhere in the elite circles of Pyongyang looking at it and say, you know, is it bolstering their own confidence that, yes, we are a fierce people?
Again, there are a lot of things going on there. One of the important things is that we have a new leader there. And, you know, I don't claim to be an expert on the leadership of North Korea. I don't really think we have experts on North Korea, just people who study it more closely. I tried to capture the lives of average people. But in my research, it seemed to me that as Kim Jong-il was groomed to be the leader by his father, Kim Il-sung, he did a series of acts to prove his mettle to the Korean Workers' Party, to the Korean People's Army, to the elites of North Korea. He was responsible for, the bombing of Flight 818 from South Korea, the planning of the Rangoon bombing. He did provocative acts to show that he was a tough leader. And I think Kim Jong-un is doing this. One of the things his father, Kim Jong-il, did often was loyalty testing people. He'd give higher-ups what looked like a chance to escape to see if they would. He would make them do horrible things to see, how dedicated they were. And Kim Jong-un grew up watching these. I just interviewed a man who was the personal chef of Kim Jong-il and kind of the nanny to Kim Jong-un for 11 years. And, we talked a great deal about loyalty testing. And I think Kim Jong-un as a new leader is really loyalty testing his nation. He's putting them on high alert to see how they respond. He's waking them up into the middle of the night. He's putting them through the ringer to just see if they really are completely dedicated to him.
And are you imagining, this is an act of imagination, but are you imagining them saying, holy cow, we're being put through all this ringer just so he can, show he's the boss? Or, yes, the threat is real and we must rise to defend the motherland or fatherland?
Well, in, the larger picture, what, average North Koreans doesn't really matter in any way. When your housing block has to do a middle-of-the-night air raid drill, you're being watched by your floor monitors. You're being watched by your departmental sector supervisors. You don't have a choice. You must snap to and act appropriately and say the right things. That's what makes it so hard to know, what average people are thinking.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We are this hour kind of imagining North Korea, maybe more than that, with new winner of the 2013 Pulitzer Prize for Fiction, Adam Johnson, author of the prize-winning book, The Orphan Master's Son, set in North Korea. He joins us today from Stanford, California. We're going to hear in a few minutes from a defector from North Korea who will join us from Seoul in South Korea. Adam Johnson, in Stanford, you said, they're humans just like us, but yet you're pointing at very big differences of people who are kind of raised with this mass mentality always being imposed on them, or the attempt to always impose it. And you've put a lot of work into imagining how that sort of changes the interior dialogue that people have. How do you think about it?
Well, for us in the Western world, and I think this is true of our movies and of our books and of our own lives. We're each of us encouraged to think of ourselves as the central character in our own lives. And much as we love everyone else, they're secondary characters, right? And we must find our own inner desires. We must move forward and act on them. We must think of our best possible selves and make choices and decisions to kind of come to that realization of who we are and who we should be. But in North Korea, it's much different. There's one central figure, and that's the dear leader. And there are 23 million secondary characters. And what they want out of life doesn't really matter. Their job is to help in the story of our central character. When you're, especially in the rural parts of North Korea, when you're a young person in school, the officials come to your school and they ascertain your aptitudes for what your possibilities might be, and they determine who will be a fisherman and who will be a ballerina. And what you want doesn't matter. Actually, your own personal desires could imperil, how well you perform the state's role. And because what you say could be used against you in certain contexts, people are trained not to communicate. And one thing we see from defectors is that even once they're free and make it out, it takes them a long time to find their voices and tell their stories. And it really is a nation without a voice. They don't write novels. They're not allowed to make their own movies. They're not allowed to express how they see the world and what it's like to live there. So I tried to help fill that in to some degree.
And yet, To some extent, you portray them as humans we would think, I guess, would, still having their own view on what's going on. I wonder if you could read a little bit for us from The Orphan Master's Son. This is kind of deep in the book, but it's a father and son walking along, and it's a moment where the father is kind of instructing his son in how to go along and get along in this totalitarian state. And we hear that, how he's the environment they're in and how he's conveying that. But at the end, it also seems like a bit of a tart private view of what's going on, and maybe some tart humor at the expense of the state. Anyway, let's listen. Could you read for us, Adam?
Certainly, I'd be happy to. This is from deep in the book. It's just a paragraph. Mm-hmm. There is a talk that every father has with his son, in which he brings the child to understand that there are ways we must act, things we must say. But inside, we are still us. We are family. I was 8 when my father had this talk with me. We were under a tree in Moranbang Hill. He told me that there was a path set out for us. On it, we had to do everything the signs commanded and heed the announcements along the way. Even if we walked this path side by side, he said, we must act alone on the outside, while on the inside, we would be holding hands. On Sundays, the factories were closed, so the air was clear, and I could imagine this path ahead, stretching across the Taedong Valley, a path lined with willows and vaulted by singular white clouds moving as a group. We ate berry-flavored ices and listened to the sounds of old men at their changi boards and slapping cards in a spirited game of ghost-top. Soon, my thoughts were of toy sailboats like the ones the Yangban kids were playing with on the pond, but my father was walking me down that path.
And then he goes on to say, my father said to me, I denounce this boy for having a blue tongue. We laughed.
That's right.
I pointed at my father, this citizen eats mustard. And it would seem to suggest to me, you're telling us that there's a pretty impish or more sense of humor there, even as they're going through the motions of obedience.
Well, you know, I thought about this as I wrote the book. I have 3 small kids. They're 8, 7, and 10 right now, but they were younger. And one of the things I wondered was, if I was a father there, would I share with them my suspicions that everything was a lie? I think most North Koreans know everything they're told is a lie. They're not fools. They're just as smart as we are. But they don't know what the truth is. You know, if you're in Pyongyang, you have one experience. The top elites live there, and they have one sense of life. They have more information. They're all loyalty tested, and they have high loyalty ratings from the government. And they have real education instead of indoctrination. When you go to the capital, you see families who are real doctors and who have real jobs, and they're walking by the Taedong River, and they're picnicking and, you know, on Mansu Hill. But, you know, when you go into the countryside, everything's different. The majority of the population lives there. It's kind of a parasitic relationship. The elites live off everyone else. And in the countryside, that's where, you know, food is an issue. Where commodities are an issue, where fuel is an issue, where people must make dangerous decisions just to survive. And those are the places, you know, we defect from. And so people defect from. Most of what we know about North Korea come from the stories of defectors from the countryside. But in the capital, which is where these people live that are depicted in that excerpt that I read, mm-hmm. they have a bit of a different reality. And I think they can take some pleasures from life.
Let's go to Laura calling from Norfolk, Virginia. Hi, Laura. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. A friend of mine and I were having a conversation the other night about North Korea. And I understand that a lot of this is kind of extrapolated into a work mm-hmm. of fiction. But I'm curious if the author could comment on, I also work in mental health, so I'm very interested in, as an American, I think it's very difficult for us to try to even imagine what it's like living in North Korea. And I wonder, are they living in a constant state of fear, such as, like, you know, in the United States we would talk about, like, a battered woman syndrome, where people stay only because they're so fearful of perhaps the consequences of attempting to leave.
Yeah.
And then my second question was, do people stay because they don't know any different? Because North Korea, all the media is so regulated, they don't have exposure to all that we do here in the United States.
Laura, those are great questions. If I may, Adam, if you'll stand by for just a second, let's take them right to one of the sources Adam Johnson is talking about as being the kind of person who can tell us more directly. Let's go right to someone who was in North Korea, grew up in North Korea, was part of the North Korean elite, defected from North Korea in 2003 with his wife and son. Joining us now from Seoul in South Korea is Mr. Kim Kwang-jin. He was a member of the elite in Pyongyang, worked as an official for the state insurance company. In 2003, way back then, he received a medal from the previous dear leader, Kim Jong-il, for stuffing two suitcases with $20 million in cash while stationed in Singapore and getting those suitcases back to the dear leader. He's now a senior fellow at South Korea's Institute for National Security Strategy. Kim Kwang-jin in Seoul, South Korea, thank you very much for joining us today.
Hello. Thank you for having me here, and thank you for waking me up in the middle of the night.
you're a good sport to do this for us. You may have heard our caller right there, Mr. Kim, asking, and I mean, you live there, you were part of the elite, maybe that's different, but her question, thinking about Adam Johnson's book and your experience in North Korea, do people live in a constant state of fear, or are they accustomed to their environment, their politics, and they live in a state of comfort somehow?
I should say it is also a hybrid. You know, they are living in a constant fear, and also they are used to that life because, you know, they are living in that world for more than half a century. So it is also a hybrid, you know, life.
You were in the elite, so maybe you were different. Adam Johnson suggests so. But do most people in North Korea, even in the elites, do they have the space in their own minds for a private internal life? Is that rubbed away by state propaganda? Who has their own mind and who doesn't in North Korea?
Majority of the people, they obey to the system, and they believe their propaganda, and they believe in the leadership. But, you know, recently it is changing, and a lot of people have doubt about the propaganda and also the leadership. So it is changing nowadays.
How do they come on that doubt? They must be sealed off from most information about the outside world. Our caller also asks about how much people know beyond their immediate circumstances in North Korea. How much?
Because, you know, they're having more information nowadays, and they see the propaganda, the slogans of the party and the regime is quite different from the practice, from the reality. So they, you know, have doubts and they're questioning, and they're also having more and more information from the outside.
How do they get that? Do they have access to the internet? I assume not. Do they have foreign publications? I assume not.
No, they don't have access to the internet, but they still can listen to the radio, and there are increasing number of, you know, internet broadcasting and radio broadcasting to North Korea by defectors and NGOs and governments like, you know, RFA and VOA and KBS here in South Korea. So they're having more information. And also there are increasing number of defectors from North Korea, and they're calling their families, and they tell what kind of life, you know, they are living in outside of North Korea, and also there is an increasing number of, you know, labor forces coming out from North Korea. So they are bringing back, you know, information about life, you know, in the outside.
North Koreans who may go to work in, what, China, for example?
Oh, yes. You know, they are sending more, you know, people, labor forces to China and also to Russia and also to the Middle East. You know, so for you know, raising money and raising hard currency. So number is growing, and they are going back, you know, after 3 or 4 years, and they are spreading information, what they saw, what they, you know, witnessed. So, you know, these informations are, they are having more informations about outside.
We are Imagining, Thinking About Life in North Korea with Adam Johnson, author of The Orphan Master's Son, and Kim Kwang-jin, joining us today from Seoul, South Korea. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's get a call from Martha in Norfolk, Virginia. Martha, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I heard an interview recently with a young man who had managed to escape one of those family gulags where he'd been since birth, and he talked about family members being separated like strangers and being forced to spy on each other for survival and for small favors. And in this case, he talked about food being so restricted and people starving, and this particular young man had betrayed his mother because he was so hungry and he was lured by a promise of a small amount of chicken for dinner if he made up some lies against her, which he did, and she was put to death. And this man will always live with this guilt, although at the time he says he felt nothing about what he had done. And I'm just wondering if your guests could talk about this question of massive starvation among the people there.
Martha, thanks for that. Kim Kwang-jin, let me bring that first to you. There have certainly been significant periods of deep hunger and even starvation. What about that? How recently? And what happens to relationships between people in North Korea when the basic elements of life, food, are in such short supply?
Right, you know, from mid 1990s, they suffer starvation, and a lot of people died. You know, the party secretary, Mr. Huang, said that around 3 million people died from starvation in that period, and now they're having again that kind of, you know, difficulties nowadays, and you know, people don't trust each other throughout their life, and you know, throughout decades, they are educated, they are brainwashed not to believe other people and to, you know, report whatever they heard, you know, whatever they hear, and whatever the others say, even family members. So, you know, they don't have trust even among family members.
Adam Johnson, when you hear the candor, the insight, the report of a defector like Kim Kwang-jin with us here in Seoul, South Korea, does it affirm your imagined understanding of North Korea? Does it raise questions for you? How's it resonate against your authorial vision?
Well, just to the last caller, you know, I think she's referring to the story of Shin Jung-hook, who is a very exceptional story. He was actually born in Camp 14, yeah. One of the rare people we know who've been through that experience. I think if you live in a town, ham-hung, and you work at a factory, and you follow the rules, and you don't try to make life your own, and you're fairly obedient, and you don't make mistakes, you're going to have a pretty normal life. You're going to get married, you're going to have kids. You're just not going to have self-realization, identity. You're just not going to be able to fulfill whatever you would want, which in the West we think is you know, what makes us human. One of the interesting things about North Korea is that we only know what we know from the stories of people who make it out. And the people who make it out are often very traumatized. It takes a long time to get out, depending on where you live. You have to cut ties with everything you know. Even if it's propaganda or even if it was a kind of evil society, it's all you knew. It was all your friends, all your community, all your common bonds. And I'll be curious to see if Mr. Kim can speak to this, but a lot of the defectors, you know, I've talked to, you know, when they leave, what the state does is punish the people who are left behind. And the people who get out kind of have PTSD or survivor's guilt because someone else pays for their freedom.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. Stirring strains there of a newly minted North Korean anthem written in honor of that country's new young leader, Kim Jong-un. We are imagining North Korea today with the new winner of the 2013 Pulitzer Prize for Fiction, Adam Johnson, author of the prize-winning book, The Orphan Master's Son. And with us in this hour from Seoul, South Korea, defector from North Korea, Kim Kwang-jin. He defected in 2003 with his wife and son, a member of the North Korean elite, now in Seoul. Bill in Hampton, Virginia. Bill, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have read Mr. Johnson's wonderful book, passed it on to a friend, and yes, it is true. Some people do not want to read about North Korea, regardless of the quality of the writing. But I'm wondering, given that the populace is learning more about the rest of the world, Kim Jong-un is consolidating his power, was raised in the West for some years, and must have a sense of humor if he's been hanging out with Dennis Rodman. I'm wondering, what is the likelihood that he may open up trade with the West and defy what his father has and grandfather have done?
We'll pick it right up there, Bill. Kim Kwang-jin in Seoul. We see the fierce warnings of nuclear attack by North Korea. We also see him hanging out with Dennis Rodman. And we do read that maybe there's a faction in North Korea that would prefer better relations with the West. What do you think are the chances of that, Mr. Kim?
Actually, for Kim Jong-un, he needs to consolidate his power. He needs to build up his own legacy. And he doesn't have enough legacies and assets from his father and grandfather. Only nuclear program and long-range missile program. So he needs to build up his own, you know, consolidate his power. So within a short period of time, he should do that. So he becomes very aggressive and very bellicose. And, you know, a lot of people expected that the new leader, the young guy who studied abroad in the Western world, might take different road, but he didn't. Because in his circumstances, you know, under his condition, he took this road to be more aggressive to the outside and to hide the difficulties and economic crisis of their own people by raising, you know, tensions and by provocating to the outside world. So I don't think he will take the proper, you know, path of bringing changes into North Korea and having fundamental reforms in North Korea in coming years and in short period of time.
I want to just ask, I know it's late there, and I'll let you go in a minute, Kim Kwang-jin, but you were part of a sophisticated circle. You lived outside North Korea and Singapore and elsewhere. You traveled. In Pyongyang, how big is the circle of international sophisticates, North Koreans who have been educated or who travel abroad? How big is the circle of people who do have a realistic understanding of the outside world? Is it 500, 5,000? I don't know. How big is it?
I should say 1% of the population. And if we include, you know, their family, it can be, you know, 10% of the population. So maybe, you know, 20,000. And then 10% is, you know, 2 million.
Mm-hmm. And do they support the regime because they're afraid if it falls, they will lose their elite position, or because they believe in it?
The former, you know, if the regime collapses, they don't have other options. So they are very much worried about their elite, about their losing of the elite position.
Well,
they don't believe in the propaganda, in the regime. You know, they know how corrupt and how much wrong they're doing, but still they don't have other options. You know, if the regime collapses, they will lose their own status and elite positions.
Do you think you will ever be in North Korea again in your lifetime, Kim Kwang-jin?
Oh, I should. You know, I should. I should go back to my hometown and rebuild the devastated, you know, village and, you know, economy there. So I really believe in that, you know, I can go back and do that.
Good luck. Kim Kwang-jin, a defector from North Korea 10 years ago, a member of the elite in Pyongyang, now in Seoul, South Korea, at South Korea's Institute for National Security Strategy. Mr. Kim, thank you so much for being up so late in the middle of the night. We're very grateful to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Best of luck to you. Adam Johnson is with us from Stanford, California. His wonderful novel, The Orphan Master's Son, has just recently won the 2013 Pulitzer Prize for Fiction. Adam, I should say, lots of people writing in. MV says it's a must-read. Kelsey says, simply fascinating, your book. AC says, totally love this book. It was brutal, dark, and comical all at the same time. You're kind enough to be here, but we've barely touched on the book. Tell us about how you structured it, who you follow through The Orphan Master's Son.
Well, first off, thank you, AC, MV, and Kelsey. You're my favorite fans.
Sure.
You know, I structured the book a great deal from reading the stories of people who make it out. We were just talking about why people defect and don't defect. It's really hard to get a portrait of Pyongyang because very few people can make it out of there, and very few people choose to because, as Mr. Kim said, you know, you're in the top 1%. You've really won the game. If you live in Pyongyang, you're not going to starve to death. And the elites, you know, are charged in North Korea of bringing the hard currency in. And it's the elite families that run counterfeiting and drug running and military sales. And actually, global insurance scams are their number one hard currency maker right now. And, you know, what the elites get in return for bringing this money into the country, because the yuan's not valued on the world market, is they get to travel to China. They get to go on shopping sprees. And the thing they want the most are to educate their kids abroad, to have, you know, real rich lives instilled in them through true education. So, you know, those are the most valuable things to them, especially with their kids. So they're willing to engage in these processes.
Take us to your protagonist, The Orphan Master's Son. It's a provocative title.
Well, the first person I interviewed who was from the North had been an orphan there. And I didn't know that I was really writing a novel. I just knew that I had read a lot of books, and I was utterly fascinated by how a human being keeps their identity there, how families stay together, how people communicate there, how love and relationships work. And this was the first person I talked to, and he had been an orphan in the North. And his story of what he went through was so overpowering to me, so shocking, the things that he had to do to survive, losing his entire family, that when I was kind of just starting the book, the only thing I knew was that my character had to do justice to this first story and to be an orphan. And the shape of the book, it's very linear for the first part of the book. My main character is, you know, an agent of the state. He does what he's told when he's told. And as long as he follows the rules, the story's fairly normal. But he does, you know, spoiler alert, go into a gulag in the middle of the book. And writing about a gulag was just so dark. I didn't like it. I read the stories of gulag survivors for a year. It was a very dark year. My wife told me to quit reading those stories because I was morose. So I left the gulag out of the book to tone it down. And in the second part of the book kind of shatters a little bit, and it's maybe a little more challenging, but it echoed how the stories were shattered from people who'd made it out.
There's a moment in the book where he is going off to America because he's through all kinds of crazy circumstances. He's made a reputation. There's a story around him that makes him kind of heroic or admirable, and he's being sent by North Korea to the United States, and he's being briefed on a cover story before that assignment, and his briefer, this is Dr. Song, talking with John Doe, the protagonist here, explains, I wonder if you could read for us, but he's explaining here that stories work, as he puts it, backwards in America from the way they do in North Korea. Could you read some of that?
Oh, I'd be happy to. Dr. Song turned to John Doe. Where we are from, he said, stories are factual. If a farmer is declared a music virtuoso by the state, everyone had better start calling him Maestro. And secretly, he'd be wise to start practicing the piano. For us, the story is more important than the person. If a man and his story are in conflict, it is the man who must change. Here, Dr. Song took a sip of juice, and the finger he lifted trembled slightly. But in America, people's stories change all the time. In America, it is the man who matters. Perhaps they will believe your story and perhaps not, but you, Jun Do, they will believe you.
Jun Do, the protagonist and the orphan master's son, headed from North Korea to the United States and into an alternate reality. Let's get a call from Oklahoma City. Jeff is calling. Hi, Jeff. You're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I just wanted to make a comment and ask a question here. I actually lived in South Korea in the late 80s because my father was stationed there.
Mm-hmm.
I was a young man at the time, so I've dealt with some of the craziness that goes on with at the border there.
Yes.
I was just curious, why has there not been more assassination attempts or attempts at revolution in North Korea, when especially looking in the contrast of Nazi Germany, where there's multiple assassination attempts on Hitler there, and then even in the Soviet Union, you had the Czech Revolution and the Hungarian Revolution. I'm curious as to why even the elites who are exposed to Western ideas, why has there not been, as far as we know anyway, any attempts to overthrow the powers that be?
This gets us into a pretty subtle region where I'm not sure even North Korean scholars in North Korea necessarily know for sure, Jeff, but we'll give it a try. Adam, what do you say?
Well, this is a very interesting question, Jeff. The amount of times assassination attempts have happened against Kim Jong-il is a subject of much conjecture. Some people say there were probably five times that they tried to kill him. A fertilizer bomb destroyed an entire town as his train went past once. Ko Young-hee, his second wife, talked about a bodyguard trying to kill him. But the bigger question is, why is there not a Korean Spring? Why did people not rise up? And I think one of the issues is this, that, you know, when the kind of people who would be brave enough to take the risk to voice opposition are the kind of people who are brave enough to escape. It's fairly dangerous. And I think through defection, opposition is bled away from the nation.
Defection, simple as that, the kind of bleeding it off. And yes, it would take a lot of courage, no question about that. Let's get one more. Shenandoah Valley, Ralph is calling. Hi, Ralph. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Just a comment. In hearing Mr. Johnson earlier, you asked him to read a passage where a father was advising his son.
Yes.
And it just calls me to think of, not to minimize the book, but calls me to think that that's a perfect description of slavery and Jim Crow here in the United States.
Keep your head down. Keep your eyes from being too aggressive. Just mind your P's and Q's.
Right, right. So just another form of slavery. That's all.
Interesting. Adam Johnson, slavery in North Korea, or kind of an equation there?
I called it a parasitic relationship between the elites in Pyongyang and the rest of the country, but I think it could be called a slave system. I mean, won isn't real money. People are just paid and just the barest amount of food to live. They're labored greatly all day long and at night. The threat of, you know, punishment, they don't have any rights. You know, I think this is a pretty fair assessment to think about how a very small ruling cadre, you know, exploits the rest of their countrymen.
So in this last month, when the threats out of North Korea have been so loud and so fierce, talking about turning, you know, New York into a sea of fire and all that, how do you think in the back of your mind about how all this may unwind in North Korea, or whether it does? Do you see this just going on more or less perpetually within its own sort of frozen state, or do you see a major change at some point? And how do you speculate, and we know it's only that might one day unfold?
Well, you know, I read the propaganda out of North Korea every day. It's easy for your callers to or your listeners to read that too. They can Google the Rodong Shinmun, which, you know, the North Koreans put out in English every morning. It's their Workers' Party newspaper. They also have a website called, you know, the KCNA, the Korean Central News Agency. and .jp. They can look that up online and read it as well. One of the things about North Korea that you need to consider is that here in America, we have different messages for different audiences. And we don't think much of it when Obama gives one speech before a teachers' union and a different speech before gun owners and targets their messages. In North Korea, there's one message. And it goes out internally and externally to everyone, even though Kim Jong-un may just be making a speech that's targeted at the military, or at the elites, or at South Korea, or at America. And it's hard for us to distinguish who he's talking to when he makes big threats like this. He may just being bellicose to prop himself up with the military, but to us it seems like he's ready to attack the world.
Well, you give us a bigger base to stand on when we look at North Korea and think about all that through your large act of imagination and no little amount of research at the same time. Adam Johnson, author of The Orphan Master's Son, 2013 Pulitzer Prize winner for fiction. Congratulations again, and thank you in the midst of all this hubbub out of North Korea for joining us to think about what may be behind it. Thank you so much, Adam.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, or follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Catherine Brewer, Julie Jopp, Sam Gail Rosen, Eileen Amata, Emily Alphen Johnson, Stefano Katsonis, James Ross, and Dean Russell, with help from Ali Harrison and Sarah Platt. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for listening. This is On Point.